Hello and welcome to Popular Volcanics, a podcast about volcanoes and this special limited edition mini-series of Popular Volcanics that we will be talking all things volcanoes for a number of purposes. One is that currently I am teaching a petrology and volcanology class for students at Denison University, and suddenly we find ourselves having to teach remotely. So we're going to be hearing a lot about volcanoes that would go along with that class. But we also are doing this for all of you, the listeners, and anyone who needs some volcano-related resources to help work your way through our unique times that we find ourselves in. So that's what we're going to be having for the next probably five or six podcasts that are going to come probably in quicker succession than normal. And with me, as always, Janine.
Hi, I'm Dr. Janine Krupner in Washington, D.C. with the Smithsonian Global Volcanism Program, and I'm very interested in making sure we get as much good resources, as many good resources out for everyone out there with kids at home or trying to keep on top of studies. So thank you, Eric, for having this idea and bringing me along.
Yes, and I should probably have introduced myself in that introduction as well. I am Dr. Eric Clementi from Denison University, and I am a professor of geosciences, and I write for Discover Magazine. So welcome to Popular Volcanics if you have not been here before. So yeah, really the goal here, there's a number of things I should point out first, is that this is kind of a multimedia extravaganza for Popular Volcanics. We're going to not only have the audio, this lovely podcast, but we will also have slides that I'm going to put the link for the page for this episode. You can download the slides that have pictures and videos of various volcanic events. There might be some handouts even, because this is also a class. We have a number of books that we're using as the source material here. If you're looking for them, I will list them out on the website as well if you want to get some new volcano books, or maybe you have them at home. And really, hopefully, everybody's going to learn a lot about how volcanoes work and some volcanoes of the different regions of the world, and about the hazards and how we can protect ourselves and manage the risk related to volcanic eruptions. Do you have any starting words, Janine, to get us rolling about all this?
I'll just add that I also have a volcano moments with myself, a series that I'm running. They're a series of 2-minute videos, most of them, with researchers around the world talking about different aspects of volcanology. So you can find those on my Twitter account, or I have a Volcano Moments with Dr. Janine Krupner channel on YouTube as well. So I have, at this point, 16, but I have a plan for at least 60 of them now, and they're probably going to be many, many more.
Remind us what your Twitter handle is.
At Janine Krupner. So it's JanineKrippner.
So yes, you should definitely check those out, and I'll be linking to some of these and talking about some of these at points over these lovely podcasts. And if you're looking for information, I am also on Twitter. I'll have be posting some of these as well. It's Eruptions Blog. And there you go. So I think we should jump right in. Today, we're starting with the basics. We're talking about styles of volcanism. And this is really just to kind of get our feet wet in how volcanologists talk about different styles of eruptions, some of the traits that some of them have, some examples, and really just getting you used to the terminology, a lot of the terminology that we use for volcanoes. And then when we start talking about some of the different volcanoes of different regions, we'll get into maybe some more of the nitty-gritty of how these eruptions work. So we are going on the very low-tech side of things, where as you can follow along at home with the slides, and every time we move on to the next slide, I will just say, next slide, and we will move on to them. They will be numbered, so we'll be able to go back and forth if you need to, but that's how it's going to work.
Where will we be putting these slides?
These will be hosted on my Google Drive space, and then they will have links from the website of for this episode. So people will be able to download them directly from our website page.
And what is our website page?
I don't remember.
This is an excellent stat. Okay, hang on. Let me Google us.
Yes.
Popular Popular Volcanics. Okay, we are popularvolcanics.weebly.com. There we go.
So I will make sure that the link is prominent for both the page itself and for the slides so that everyone can track these things down. But yes, these podcasts are going to be a little bit more rough and tumble than we've done in the past. So enjoy. So yes, back to Styles of Volcanism. We have slides. And I think what we're going to start off with is if we move on to slide number two, we can talk about why different volcanoes erupt the way they do. And it really boils down to three things: the stuff, the temperature, and the water. Am I right?
Yeah. Especially with these beautiful oceanic volcanoes. So we have in the picture here a picture of Nishinoshima volcano, which is off the coast of Japan. So it's a pretty recent island that has formed. It's been growing off the seafloor for quite a while. But on the surface, it's kind of a brand new baby volcano.
Yeah, really the style of volcanism in these eruptions changed, this eruption in particular changed as the amount of water was involved. But really, if we back up a little bit, we know that there are different types of magma that erupt, and they have different amounts of elements like silica. Stuff with more silica is stickier. Stuff with less silica is runnier. That means that stickier lavas tend to erupt more explosively. Runnier lavas tend to erupt more like lava flows. So that's the compositional end of it. Temperature-wise, the hotter things are, the less sticky they are as well. So that enters into it. And then the amount of gas that's dissolved into that magma will also give us a hint of whether it's going to be more explosive or less explosive, depending on how easily that gas can get out. And then all that water that is around our island volcano here, if it gets mixed in with that lava that's erupting, it can become more explosive, even if it doesn't have a lot of these other criteria that make things tend to be more explosive.
So when we have our magma interacting with water in a certain way, where it's actually efficiently mixing, we have a fuel coolant interaction that happens. So what happens is that the water flashes to steam, and it's, what is it, around 1,000 times volume increase nearly instantaneously. And so if you can imagine a bucket of water expanding by about 1,000 times in volume immediately and blowing everything apart as it's doing so. So that's why we get these explosive eruptions where we normally might have something more like a quiet lava flow.
Yep, and it is a bit of a Goldilocks situation where you want to have the mixture of water to magma be just right, because too much water, you don't get more explosivity. You might get something even like pillows, undersea eruptions rather than something more explosive. And not enough water, well, then you don't do anything because there's not enough water to change what the magma's doing anyway. So you have that just right situation to produce more explosivity. All right, so let's move on to slide number three. And that's where we're going to classify stuff, because this is the terminology. If, you know, for every discipline, for every field, there's specific words that we like to use to talk about the stuff that gets erupted. Now, lava is solidified molten rock. That's easy enough. But when we have the stuff that's being thrown out of a volcano when it is explosively erupting, we have different terms to talk about these types of things. And maybe, Janine, do you want to walk us through the different classifications?
Yeah, so we have this triangle here. And on the three points, the uppermost is blocks and bombs. And those are any chunks of rock or lava coming out of the volcano that are greater than 64 millimeters in size. So the blocks are the more solid chunks, and the bombs, they're not exploding as such, but they are more fluid. So they're actually changing shape. And they can make some really awesome morphologies as they're flying and then landing on the ground. On the lower left, we have lapilli. Those are chunks of lava or rock that are erupting that are between 64 millimeters and 2 millimeters in size. And then we have volcanic ash, which is any rock that's coming out that is less than 2 millimeters in size.
So you can kind of see on the right side, the pictures kind of give you a sense of the scale of these things. But volcanic bombs, they can be anywhere. So 64 millimeters is what, about 6.5 centimeters. And that is the bottom of the scale. Bombs and blocks can be huge as well. They can be car-sized chunks of material being thrown out of the volcano. So we have a lot of a lot of things that are classified as blocks and bombs. But really, when we look at big explosive eruptions, at least, that ash, although it's teeny tiny, can make up a huge volume of the material that's being spit out during an eruption.
I was going to say, that's what we saw with the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010, is that there was an ash plume that was going over Europe, and you couldn't really see it, but it was still enough to cause a lot of problems.
Yep, and it's that ash that can accumulate rapidly over wide areas if the eruption is large enough, that then can also keep on moving after the eruption's over, either in the wind or in the rain. So ash is a hazard that is derived from something that would seem insignificant if you just saw a little pile of this really fine, it's even finer than it can feel sandy, but it's even finer than sand a lot of the time. But it's really tiny little shards of volcanic glass or chunks of rock or crystals, which I think moves us on to slide number 4. And that's the types of ash and why they're important. We got two pictures here because there are two main types of ash, and then one that's I didn't have a picture of that's related. So we have accidental ash and juvenile ash. And the accidental ash is stuff that got shattered because it was there when the eruption was happening. It might be chunks of rock. So this picture of accidental ash from Redoubt in Alaska shows really blocky, chunky bits of rock that got shattered during an explosion and shattered to the point where is the size of ash. And you end up spreading that everywhere. Juvenile ash is actually bits of volcanic glass made of magma. And on the right there is a picture of juvenile ash from just this last January at Taal in the Philippines. So what do you think of that picture of the Taal ash? I think it's super cool.
Oh, I love it. So the picture that we're looking at is an SEM image. So it's basically a gray scale image of this volcanic ash. And you can see these elongate kind of patterns on it, and that's gas bubbles that were coming out of the magma as it was erupting, and they've been stretched as the magma is erupting. So that is really cool. And a way to think of juvenile versus accidental, so juvenile is generally meaning young, right? So this is really fresh magma that is erupting during this eruption, and the accidental stuff is getting caught up by accident. It was already there, minding its own business, and then this juvenile stuff came blasting through and took the accidental stuff with it.
Yeah, so the accidental stuff is really being produced by shattering that old rock, but that juvenile is being formed by gas bubbles trying to escape as fast as they can and growing as fast as they can in that magma and causing what we call fragmentation. It's just a fancy way of saying that that magma can't hold itself together anymore because of all the bubbles. And you get these,
which we are all relating to right now with the current COVID-19 crisis.
Yes,
right?
Indeed. But the ash that we have from Taal and the bubbles, it has that shape that we expect where things are nicely, the word we use is cuspate. It looks like little edges of bubbles and things that are produced by the eruptions. The juvenile ash. So why is it important that we know the difference between accidental and juvenile ash?
So this is actually incredibly important because when we see when a volcano is ramping up towards an eruption, sometimes we have what's called a phreatic eruption first. And this is an eruption that is driven by steam. So we have a lot of fluids in volcanoes, whether it's water that is rainwater that has been leaking down through the system. And when that's heated up, that can build up steam. If that gets trapped, we can get a phreatic explosion. So the only way to tell if that is phreatic or if magma is now at the surface, if it's magmatic, is looking at these ash samples. So if we see these fresh, glassy ash shards, that is telling us the magma is at the surface. This volcano means business. We are actually having a magmatic eruption now.
This is one of the first things that when we have this unrest, that if stuff is coming out the top, volcanologists want to figure this out quickly, just so they can begin to get a sense of what they might be in store. Now there's all these other signs that people will be looking for, like earthquakes and gas emissions and deformation of the volcano. So changing shape as maybe magma's rising up underneath it, but just merely the shape of this ash and identifying whether it's accidental or juvenile is a good clue of what might be in store as this eruption goes on. All right, let's see. Slide number five. We can talk about the types of volcanoes, because volcanoes are not all the same. I know we think about volcanoes, a lot of people, if you ask to draw a volcano, will make a nice steep-sided cone. And that's okay, because a lot of volcanoes are like that. But we have a lot of variety in the shapes of volcanoes, and it has a lot to do with what they erupt. So the volcanoes that erupt things that are running to make lava flows tend to make large, broad volcanoes. So those are the shield volcanoes. And I, of course, in our slide presentation, if you were to head over there and see the picture I chose a volcano that I chose poorly because I don't even want to try to pronounce. I chose an Icelandic volcano, which looks like Skjaldbjörn.
Yep, you're on your own.
But I probably... Yeah. So I think it was just a very nice picture, but you get the idea that the slopes are really broad and low, and you'd almost, if you didn't know you were looking for a volcano, you might miss it entirely because it's such a flat, broad shape.
So if you think of Mauna Loa or Mauna Kea in Hawaii, those are some really well-known volcanoes, and they're actually huge. These things are absolutely huge. When you think of that, they're rising from the bottom of the ocean floor all the way to the surface, and then I don't even know how high they are above the water there, but they're such broad things because the lava is really runny. It can flow far away, so it's kind of stretching out and leaving very thin lava flows, whereas if you have more sticky lava, you're going to have more thick lava flows that don't travel as far. So that's our shield volcano, but they can still produce explosive eruptions too.
And shield volcanoes are probably the most common volcano in the solar system, because if we look at other planets, we can identify shield volcanoes on places like Venus and Mars and Io, because basaltic lava, that runny stuff you picture from Hawaii, is also the most common type of lava out there in the solar system. Basaltic eruptions don't have to be big all the time to create a shield volcano. We have what are known as scoria cones or cinder cones, where you have basaltic lava that might be a little more gas charged, smaller volume, spitting out debris, bombs, and lapilli, and making a cone that's just a pile of loose volcanic material with maybe a lava flow coming at the bottom. And probably, to me, the most famous one of these scoria cones is Wizard Island inside of Crater Lake in Oregon. Having formerly been a park ranger at Crater Lake, I can share the idea that Crater Lake is in fact named after the crater on top of Wizard Island and not the giant caldera that it's sitting in. But Wizard Island is a feature that's maybe a kilometer across and a few hundred, maybe 100 meters tall, but you had basaltic lava spitting out a little more explosively. And cinder cones cover Central Oregon and different areas where you have the style of volcanism, they're pretty common.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting choice too, because this was Crater Lake, or, oh my goodness, I'm totally blanking on the actual name of that volcano.
Mazama,
there we go. Mazama, about 7,700 years ago, produced this enormous eruption that blew its top off and left this huge hole, which is now the deepest lake in America. So when we see these big volcanoes that produce these big, exciting, explosive eruptions, people often think that that's what that volcano does. But they more often than not produce these much smaller eruptions. So this volcano had this massive eruption and then has produced many eruptions since then that have just produced this little square cone and lava flows.
Yep. So it's, again, calderas are impressive, but they actually, you know, if you drive around Crater Lake today, you'll find a lot more cinder cones, some of which predate the big eruption, but they're pretty common around many volcanic provinces. All right, let's move on to things that are produced by what we call intermediate lava. So it's, again, we're talking about Goldilocks, where basalt has the lowest amount of silica, and intermediate lavas are in the middle, andesite and dacite. And this is where we get the volcanoes that I think people picture in their mind. So stratovolcanoes, what can you tell us about Mayon?
Mayon is such a gorgeous volcano. This is one of these really near symmetrical volcanoes that has produced a lot of lava flows, but also a lot of pyroclastic flows and ash flames too. So these volcanoes can really just about do anything. They can have these lava flows, which are a little more runnier than your higher silica lava flows, but they can also be extremely dangerous and extremely explosive.
And if you're looking at the picture, or look up, just Google almost any picture of Mayan, you can see this, how steep the slopes are, but how you can see the difference between areas that are covered in lava flows. So a nice, this picture I'm looking at on the slide here has a nice dark lava flow coming straight at you in the picture. It's not an active lava flow. It's an older lava flow. But then the rest of the slopes, they kind of have this look. After you see enough volcanoes and see enough volcanic material, you get an eye for how things look after they've been weathered. And piles of loose volcanic debris get a look from weathering, especially in places like the Philippines, where there's a lot of rain. And this kind of, it has that look of a mix of lava flows and loose material, volcanic tephra. Tephra is the catch-all for sort of volcanic debris. And that's what Mayan is, this sort of layer cake of tephra and lava flows. On the other side of things is what we call a composite volcano. And that's made up, instead of it being a nice, graceful, single cone, it might be a whole bunch of cones and vents where the lava comes out or the explosive material comes out, all stacked on top of each other. And Mount Shasta in California is a great example of a composite volcano. In fact, it's probably two volcanoes stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, we have Shasta and Shastina, right?
And there's a number of vents that are related to Shasta that are all kind of stacked up on top of each other. And that, again, is a common feature for these intermediate volcanoes that are a mix of lava flows and tephra that are erupted in both explosive eruptions and in more effusive lava flow style eruptions, but much stickier. One difference between Mayan and Shasta is that Shasta is erupting stuff that's even stickier than the stuff that's coming out at Mayan.
Yeah, so we have some pretty decent lava domes at Shasta too, don't we? So lava domes are when the magma is very sticky. It doesn't want to move very easily. It's not too gassy, so it's not producing explosive eruptions, although it can as well, because volcanoes don't like us to classify them. But it's this big plug of magma that comes up, and at the surface it's now lava, and these different sections of new lava coming up and just kind of building up in place forms these really big lava domes. And they're extremely dangerous because they can produce pyroclastic flows or block and ash flows when they don't collapse. They can produce ash plumes, and they can also collapse with no volcanic activity occurring. So they can be pretty unpredictable at times as well.
Yeah, you can even get long lava flows out of these styles of andesite and dacite volcanoes that sometimes we refer to some of them as coulees, that are long, steep-sided flows, lava flows that can travel for many kilometers away from the volcano. And I worked on one in Chile that was just covered in these dacite lava flows that are 30 meters tall, that come from this maybe more gas-poor eruptions that are associated also with explosive events, but you can get lava flows at these eruptions. And if we move on to slide 7, we can see some more lovely sticky lavas that can erupt as domes. So we'll start on the right side. There is a lava dome flow at Newberry Volcano in Oregon. It is named aptly the Big Obsidian Flow, because it is a big obsidian flow that was produced. I'm failing. How old is the Big Obsidian Flow? Do you remember? It's like 1,000 years old.
I was just working on this not long ago. Hang on, let me Google it. Big Obsidian.
It's young.
It's only 1,500 years old.
Okay, so I wasn't that far off. So it's a young, maybe. If you could imagine a huge vat of obsidian, of volcanic glass oozing out of the ground, probably with ash and other things coming with it. That's what was happening at Newberry Volcano near Bend in Oregon. So this is a rhyolite volcano, so the stickiest lava we know of. That is high silica, and it produces these amazing flows and domes, but also can produce these massive explosions that can produce calderas like Kilauea in Ecuador. That is a massive hole in the ground produced by collapsing land surface after you've erupted all of this material out.
Rhyolites, they're the ones that tend to get the bad rap. So Yellowstone has a lot of rhyolite, but it also has a lot of basalt. And I think that's something that's really important to keep in mind, is that volcanoes can produce different lava types. You can have a rhyolite eruption, which produces a huge caldera collapse eruption, and then you could have 20 or 60 basaltic lava flows after that and little scoria cones. So volcano types are great for a really easy first level glance at a volcano, but volcanoes can produce so many different styles of eruptions and different lava types as well. So that's something important to keep in mind, is that volcanoes don't care how we classify them. They do what they want.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you look at Newberry, it has a whole field of basaltic volcanoes that are associated with it around it. The caldera itself in the picture, if you look at the slide on the right, the picture of Newberry, you see the two little lakes in the background. They're part of a caldera collapse that formed at Newberry. There's a number of big explosive rhyolite eruptions. There's another little cinder cone that is the sort of bridge between the two lakes. And then this lava flow that is obsidian, that is eruption of rhyolite that was effusive rather than a big explosion. So Newberry has all sorts of different compositions and styles of eruption in a single volcanic area. So it's pretty cool. All right. So let's move on to talk about, this one is just kind of getting at where volcanic eruptions can happen on a volcano. Because again, what I think a lot of people picture is a nice steep-sided cone and everything's coming out the top. And that's actually somewhat, it's not, I don't want to say it's rare, it happens a lot, but it's also not the only place that lava can and explosive eruptions can happen on a volcano. So we have, if it's coming out the top, obviously we call it something like a summit eruption. But then you can have eruptions that are happening out on the edges, whether it's a flank eruption where something is happening on the edge of the volcano. You can have lateral eruptions where the main eruption is happening off on the edge of the volcano, when you might have some stuff coming out at the top. And then parasitic eruptions, which are just things happening in close proximity to another volcano that might not necessarily be directly associated with that main big edifice that's there.
And this is a really important point, because if you're a volcano observatory with all of these different specialties to monitor volcanoes and try to figure out what's going on, one of the big questions is, where is the volcano going to erupt? Now, if we're lucky, it just erupts at the summit and everything is fine. But like with Argonne in 2017, there was an intrusion of magma that was occurring off to the side of the volcano, causing deformation. So the ground was actually uplifting a little bit, but then the main eruption still happened at the summit. So volcanoes can be jerks sometimes and can erupt where we don't want them to. And unfortunately, that sometimes happens under towns or cities, as we saw with Kilauea in 2018.
Yep. And that's, I mean, we looked at eruptions at Eyjafjallajökull in Iceland, and that one started off as an eruption off on the side of the volcano and progressed into one that was coming out of the summit area of the volcano. So eruptions can come from different parts of the volcano, and they can change as the eruption goes on, depending on how that magma is being fed and traveling once it's underneath the volcano. So let's talk a little bit about different volcanic styles, just really in a broad brush, because we classify different eruptions based on how they're being produced and what they produce. And there's kind of four main types, although there's a whole bevy of subtypes of volcanic eruptions. So although we're only really going to talk about Hawaiian eruptions, Strombolian, Vulcanian, and Plinian eruptions, there's all sorts of other ones, Tsertsian eruptions and Pelean eruptions, and I think, what's the submarine style one? Neptunian eruptions, I believe, is an official one these days.
Yeah, no, I hadn't actually heard of that before. That's brand new to me right now.
But we're going to really talk about the big four. And the first one, again, we're going to start with stuff that erupts basalt, are Hawaiian style eruptions. So on this slide here, hopefully if you got PowerPoint and you can look at this, the image on the left is actually a video that you can click on. But the Hawaiian style eruptions, in class at least, all of my students should be familiar with the fact that we've talked about them already. We've talked about the stages of Hawaiian volcanism that we have over the 100+ years that people have monitored volcanoes in Hawaii. They've developed a scheme, a pattern of what happens for Hawaiian-style volcanism. Now, although we call it Hawaiian-style volcanism, it's not only found in Hawaii. There's lots of places that see Hawaiian-style volcanism. Can you think of any good examples there, Janine?
Nope. I'll come back to you on that one.
All right. Sorry to throw that at you unexpectedly.
It's okay. I haven't actually had coffee today yet, so we're doing okay.
Oh, no. Okay, let me think. I can think quickly. Piton de la Fournaise on Reunion Island. There's
that's
one.
Yeah, and we also have the volcanoes in the Galapagos as well.
The Galapagos. Yep. So a lot of the times, this Hawaiian-style volcanism is related to hot spots. So places where hot mantle material is rising up underneath the surface, and it causes melting to happen, and you get lots of basalt erupting if you're at least on an oceanic plate. So Hawaii or the Canary Islands or the Galapagos or Reunion, these are all places where you get this Hawaiian-style volcanism where the volcano inflates, and then it's all that magma rising to the surface releases a whole bunch of gases that we call dense fumes. And they tend to come out in these cracks that were formed thanks to all that inflation. And then that lava kind of just starts spattering out. We call it fragmental ejecta or fragmented ejecta, where you get bombs and spatter and the sort of bubbling lava coming out of these fissures, which eventually the hose gets turned up even more and you get the curtain of fire, followed by all of that curtain of fire coming to erupt from a single point or maybe a few single points that we call central vents that can last for months or longer. And eventually you get a pattern of lava flows and lava lakes in a lot of these volcanoes.
Yeah, the Kilauea 2018 sequence was a really good example of this. So we had the inflation, there were different lava lakes that drained, the Halema'uma'u and the Pu'u'u. And then there were a few vents that opened up, and they had more thick, viscous spattering. Then we had more vents opening up, and then the really runny stuff came, and there was these huge lava fountains, lava shooting up into the air, forming big lava flows, and a lot of really obnoxious gases that came through that. And that actually made it its way down over to the other islands as well. So they can be pretty nasty eruptions, even though they look gorgeous. They can be very nasty.
Yep. So Hawaiian-style eruptions, we tend to think of them. They usually don't have a big, tall ash plume associated with them, unless you get things like what happened in Hawaii, where there's some water involved up at the summit. You tend to get lava flows, the famous ones being, of course, Pahoehoe and A'a lava flows, Pahoehoe being the ropey stuff, and A'a being that rough, rubbly stuff. And it's really shield volcanoes are the home to most Hawaiian style eruptions, because you want that runnier basalt lava to produce that type of eruption. So next up, we have Strombolian style eruptions, named after Stromboli in the Aeolian Islands off of Italy. They are the first style of eruption that has a pretty significant explosive component. So what you want to picture with a Strombolian eruption is you have big bubbles or big areas full of bubbles that are rising up in a column of magma underneath the vent where it comes out, and those bubbles will pop. And those popping bubbles send spattering lava out of the volcano. It might go hundreds of meters above the volcano. Sometimes you have these really impressive fire fountains that are caused by it. And you get these ash plumes, they call them coliform. They kind of sound like cauliflower because that's what you want to kind of picture in your head. But you get this repeated explosions of volcanic bombs and debris that come out. And then lava flows sometimes as well that are really, Strombolian eruptions we tend to find in places that are erupting basalt or maybe something a little more full of silica like basaltic andesite. You find them at cinder cones and stratovolcanoes, but it's this repeated pattern of big slugs of bubbles rising up and popping at the surface that makes the Stromboli eruption so dramatic.
Yeah, it's all to do with that rising gas. So you can have what we call discrete explosions. So you might have one bubble that's bursting at the surface and that's it. But then you can have more bubbles coming at a more rapid pace, and then you can get a lot of explosions really, really close together. And if you get more continuous gas coming out, so a higher exit velocity, you have more of it coming out faster, that's when you get these lava fountains that can transition into that as well. And those can go several kilometers into the air. There was a 2-kilometer high lava fountain at Etna a few years ago and 1.5-ish kilometers at Villarrica in Chile a couple of years ago.
I find it sort of astonishing to think about lava fountaining a couple kilometers up into the air. It's just that I can't imagine. I've never been eyewitness to one of those sorts of events, but just seeing video of Etna when it's in its sort of full glory is quite impressive, to think lava being ejected from the volcano at that sort of force.
Oh yeah, that is definitely in the top 10 of things I want to see before I die. The scale of it, I can't even imagine seeing. I mean, if you think of how high is the Empire State Building? What's that, several hundred meters? So a couple of those on top of each other is just insane.
Yep. And, you know, although Strombolian eruptions, we talk about the stuff spattering, most of it stays within a couple kilometers of the vent. It can produce ash that can cause problems. I know airports in Sicily get closed because of the ash. Like I said, it can produce lava flows. Occasionally, you can get pyroclastic flows in these eruptions. But it's really the fountaining of lava during a really vigorous eruption, or the sort of periodic bursting of that bubble at the surface, that sets Strombolian eruptions apart. Vulcanian style. Now, Vulcanian are a little different, because the first two that we talked about, Hawaiian and Strombolian, they're really caused by, what you'd find if you looked at the material, it's all juvenile, mostly all juvenile, where you have fresh lava that's made it to the surface and is driving the eruption. But Vulcanian eruptions, this is when people like to refer to them as the sort of throat clearing eruptions that happen at volcanoes, sometimes leading up to something that might be more Strombolian or Plinian, or sometimes just on their own. And they're really events where you have cold material plugging up the vent and pressure building. And eventually that pressure gets so high that you blast material out of the volcano hundreds of meters, maybe kilometers or tens of kilometers above the volcano. And you throw all this material out that is, a lot of it is accidental, but it is being driven by that pressure that's building underneath a plug that forms in the volcano.
Yeah, there's definitely a range of juvenile and accidental material we get. So if you Google on YouTube, go look at Krakatoa. There are a lot of videos of volcanic explosions at Krakatoa, especially at nighttime. At night, you can see the incandescence or the hot glow of fresh material coming out. So there's a lot more you can see at night during the day too. So go check that out.
But yeah, Vulcanian eruptions, the other thing that's kind of important about them is that they really are, they're very rarely any sort of lava flows associated with Vulcanian, because it's really blasting this material out explosively. And it tends to be in volcanoes that, again, are getting a little more sticky in terms of what they're erupting out the top.
Probably these are really, really frequent around the world. I don't actually know the numbers of what are the most frequent style of eruptions, but this probably is the most frequent style, right? That there are volcanic or ash plumes going off all the time around the world.
Yeah, one would imagine that pressure, if you have gases coming off of magma somewhere beneath the volcano and you have a plug at the top that is made of material that can fracture, yeah, you're going to have this pretty commonly happen at a lot of volcanoes without it needing to be in a place where there's a large eruption on the way. That this is sort of the periodic releasing of that pressure inside the conduit, as we call it, underneath the vent that the stuff's coming out.
Yeah, like you can get volcanoes like Sokorojima volcano in Japan that can have several of these a day for years on end. So there are volcanoes that can just produce these style of eruptions over and over and over and over again.
Yep, and you get all these sort of volcanic bombs and blocks being thrown everywhere, some of them the size of cars or refrigerators. So it's
fridge-sized refrigerators.
Fridge-sized refrigerators? One would hope so. But they're eruptions that can be, I think, what I'm thinking of with the Sakurajima is the fact that you have a volcano that is sitting nearly inside the city there. Was it Kagoshima City? And people live with these sort of constant explosions coming from the volcano. They have to make some adjustments to their life depending on what the volcano is doing. If the ash is blowing the wrong way, you might have to be more worried about the ash or close the airports or things. But it is a constant in some of these areas that this volcano is going to be restless and producing explosions. Our last style of eruption are Plinian style eruptions. They're the big ones that produce the ash columns that spread out as they reach the point where they can't rise anymore. And they produce these giant umbrella shaped columns. I mean, the picture, if you were to look at the picture and the little video that I have on our slides, it's a picture of Sarachev Peak in the Kuril Islands. And you have this lovely set of images taken from the International Space Station as it went by, as this volcano was starting to erupt. And you can see beginnings of a real tall Plinian column that are over 20 kilometers tall. You know, subplinian eruptions are about 20 kilometers. Plinian are taller than that, up to 50 kilometers, and ultraplinian are even taller than that, maybe over 50 kilometers of ash and debris going straight up and then spreading out into the atmosphere. Lots of ash, shockingly enough, mostly juvenile, but also some accidental. And I didn't mention before this idea of cognate ash, which is maybe material associated with the eruption, might be blocks of stuff that get shattered in the process as well. But this is what's producing huge ash fall and pyroclastic flows and what that we associate with volcanoes that erupt andesite and dacite and rhyolite. Really, rhyolite and dacite volcanoes produce these big explosive events.
Yeah, these are the dangerous ones. I mean, they're all dangerous depending on how close you are to the volcano. And keep in mind too that the hazard you're facing changes as you move away from the volcano. So these really large Plinian eruptions can produce very large pyroclastic flows as well, and also lahars. If you have snow melt, a lot of debris, a lot of hot ash, sometimes you can get hot lahars, can travel tens or hundreds of kilometers away from the volcano, and you get pyroclastic flows from different ways of forming them. So you can get pyroclastic flows that are going straight down the side. They're kind of bubbling over from the vent. You can get part of that ash plume, because remember, volcanic ash is solid rock. It's heavy stuff. If you have the vent widening, for example, if you have a lot of erosion at the vent as it's erupting, that can produce large pyroclastic flows. Or if you have a change in velocity or how much material is coming out, that can produce pyroclastic flows. So luckily, generally speaking, the larger the eruption, the more rare it is. So we don't see a whole lot, and I'm speaking in human terms, in our lifetime, you don't see a huge amount of Plinian style eruptions, but they're incredibly dangerous for a long distance from the vent.
You can Google or look at the slides of the Sarachev Peak eruption, and you can see pyroclastic flows that are going down the sides of the island that are sort of the bubbling over of eruptions. And then you can imagine that at that ash column goes up, at some point it can't go up anymore and it will start to collapse and produce more pyroclastic flows as that material collapses. And what are the ways that you think of to produce a Plinian eruption?
You need a lot of magma coming out really fast and a lot of gas.
So they can be triggered just from magma rising up underneath the volcano and reaching the surface, or there are plenty of eruptions that can be formed from lava domes that are collapsing and releasing that pressure as well, if I'm correct. Am I right here or am I wrong?
You're right. I worked on Shibuya Chokan on Kamchatka, and that had a few plenty of eruptions associated with large dome collapse events. So you have a huge amount of this cooler dome material for collapsing on the volcano, producing block and ash flows, and then you can have a Plinian eruption. And it's hard to tell, honestly, if the Plinian eruption triggers a collapse or the collapse triggers the Plinian eruption, because you can't see what's going on. It's a mess. You cannot see the vent at that point.
Yes, I imagine that's not the sort of thing you want to hang too close to see exactly what's going on. But yes, they are common at these volcanoes that have really the sticky lava that can either plug up the vent and cause a lot of pressure to build, or just trap bubbles until they will shatter so vigorously to produce explosions that travel tens of kilometers, 30, 40 kilometers up. And it always blows my mind when I think about the idea that, and that was not a pun, I apologize. It blows my mind that bubbles can drive such impressive explosive events. Just the fact that you have gas bubbles forming can have that much energy involved. And that's one of those bits of nature that I've always found fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can also get Frieto Plinian eruption. So that's a Plinian eruption that's driven by that magma water interaction we spoke about before. So that was a big danger with the Taal volcano that was erupting a few months ago. So Taal is an island and a lake and an island and a lake. Is that right?
Something like that.
Anyway, something like that, although not anymore. And so when you have a volcano that has a large lake, once you get the magma interacting directly with the water, that's when you can get these Plinian style eruptions too. But then we call them Frieto Plinian because that's the water aspect.
So I think that kind of gets all of our major styles of eruption, that we have our Hawaiian style eruptions that are lava flows with some fountaining. We have the Strombolian, where you have these gas bubbles reaching the surface, either causing discrete pops or continuous lava fountains. You got Vulcanian eruptions that are caused by the pressure building underneath a plug of lava in the vent, and then Plinian eruptions that just the whole volcano produces an ash column that can tower 30, 40, 50 kilometers above the volcano and spread ash and pyroclastic flows for tens or hundreds or thousands of kilometers away from the volcano. So when we talk about eruptions in the weeks to come, these are kind of how we are going to categorize a lot of them. And some of them are going to cause hazards near the volcano, and some of them are going to cause hazards very far from the volcano.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is all a spectrum. So there are sometimes, and I'm looking at an ash plume, and I can't tell if that's strictly Vulcanian or Plinian. These are what we are using to describe what we're seeing. But volcanoes don't care. They can change eruption style during an eruption. So they're very complicated. They have their own personalities and they have their own mood swings. But this is the terminology that helps us communicate what we are witnessing or what we are studying.
Exactly. So next time we're going to start talking about the volcanoes of Europe. So we'll think a little bit about why there are volcanoes in Europe and then some of the more famous and hazardous volcanoes, things like Etna and Vesuvius. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about the volcanoes in Western Germany, which most people don't think about. But that's what's going to be coming up on our next special mini-series edition of Popular Volcanics. So I think with that, I'll hand it off to Janine to say bid you adieu until next time.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. I really hope that this is helping out people at home or students. We're all in this together right now with the COVID-19. This is a really stressful time, so I hope that us doing this is helping in some small way. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, feel free to send us questions that you might want us to try to tackle in some of these podcasts. Be sure to check out Janine's videos on YouTube about all sorts of cool questions about volcanoes. And we'll be back sooner than usual to talk about the volcanoes of Europe. So until then, stay safe, stay calm, and we'll talk to you then.
Bye. So far, I just can't.